Famulus's time-tested entrepot, over the course of the next day or so, the matter's hashed out, and it's decided that while there's no real reason to involve Boone, or Stice, or Strzok, or Trolch, it's really Famulus and Axford and Hal's right, duty, almost, to the spirits of inquiry and good trade practice, to sample the potentially incredibly potent DMZ in predeterminedly safe amounts before unleashing it on Boone, or Trolch, or any unwitting civilians. Axford, having been allowed in on the front end, the question of Hal's defraying the opportunity cost of his part in the experiment is tactfully broached and turns out to be no problem. Famulus's markup isn't anything beyond accepted norms, and there's always room in Hal's budget for spirited inquiry. Hal's one condition is that somebody tech-literate actually take the truck down to BU or MIT's medical library and physically verify that the compound is both organic and non-addictive, which Famulus says a physical hands-on library assault is already down in his day planner in pen anyway. After PM drills on Thursday, as Hal Incandenza and Famulus, with camera-mounted Mario Incandenza in tow, stand with their hands in the chain-link mesh of one of the show court's fencing, and watch Teddy Schock play a private exhibition against a Syrian satellite pro who's at ETA for 2 paid weeks of corrective instruction on a service motion that's eroding his rotator cuff. The guy wears thick glasses with a black athletic band around his head and plays with an upright, square-jawed, liquid precision and is dispatching Ted Schock handily, which Schock is taking with his customary sanguine good temper, giving his stolid all, learning what he can, one of very few genuinely stocky players at ETA, and one of the even fewer ranked junior players around without an apparent ego, wholly non-insecure since he blew out his knee on a contre-pied in the pre-Thanksgiving exhibition 3 years back, which is odd. Now, still in and at it just for the fun, and more or less doomed, therefore, to a purgatorial existence in 128 to 256 Alphabetville. As Famulus and Hal stand there, sweaty in full red and gray ETA sweats, on a raw 11:05 p.m., the sweat in their hair starting to accrete and freeze, Mario's head bowed under the weight of the head-mount rig and his hideously arachnodactylic fingers whitening as the fence takes his forward weight, Hal's posture subtly but warmly inclined ever so slightly toward his tiny older brother, who resembles him the way creatures of the same order but not the same family might resemble one another. As they stand watching and hashing matters out, Hal and Famulus, there's the thud and sprong of an EWD transnational catapult off way below to their left, and then the high keen sound of a waste displacement projectile the clowns are too low to let them see the flight of, though a weirdly yellow sheep-shaped cloud is visible somewhere up off past Acton, connecting the horizon seam to some kind of coming storm front, held off by the ATH-SCME fans, along the Lowell-Methuen stretch of border northwest. Famulus finally nixes the notion of performing the spirited controlled experiment here in Enfield, where Axford has to be at the A-Squad's dawn drills every morning at 0500, and also Hal, unless he's slept over at the headmaster's house the night before, with the headmaster's house just not being a good DMZ dropping venue at all. Famulus, scanning up and down the length of the fence and winking at Mario, posits that a solid 36 hours of demand-free time will be advisable for any interaction with the incredibly potent you-know-what-ski. That also lets out the inter-academy thing with Port Washington tomorrow, for which Charles Tavis has chartered 2 buses because so many ETA players are getting to go and do battle in this one. Port Washington Academy is gargantuan, the Xerox Inc. of North American tennis academies, with over 300 students and 64 courts, half of which they'll have already put under warm inflatable Testar cover as of, like, Halloween, PW staff being less into the value of elemental suffering than Stitt and company. So many that Tavis will almost surely go ahead and bust them all back up from Long Island just as soon as the post-competition dance is over, rather than shell out for all those motel rooms without corporate support. This ETA, PW meet, and buffet, and dance are private inter-academy tradition, an epic rivalry almost a decade old. Plus, Pamela says he'll need a couple weeks of quality med library stacks tossing time to do the more exacting titration and side effects research Hal agrees the soldier's sobering story seems to dictate. So, they conclude, the window of opportunity looks to be 11:20 to 21, the weekend right after the big end-of-fiscal-year fundraising exhibition with the ETA, A and B squads, in singles against this year, Quebec's notoriously hapless Junior Davis and Junior Whiteman Cup squads.
74.
Invited down under very quiet, low-profile political conditions via the good expatriate offices of Averill and Condensa to get vivisected by Wayne and Hal and others for the philanthropic amusement of ETA patrons and alums, then to dance the PM away at a catered supper and alumni ball. The weekend right before Thanksgiving week and the Whataburger Invitational in sunny Arizona. Because this year, in addition to Friday, 11:20, they also get Saturday, 11:21 off. As in, from both class and practice. Because CT and Schtitt have arranged a special one-match doubles exhibition for the Saturday AM following the big meet. One between two female coaches of the Quebecois Whitemans and ETA's infamous Vaught twins, Karen and Sharon Vaught, 17. ONAN's top-ranked junior women's doubles team, unbeaten in 3 years, an unbeatable duo, uncanny in their cooperation on the court, moving as one at all times, playing not just as if but in fact because they shared a brain, or at least the psychomotor lobes of one, the twins, Siamese, fused at the left and right temple, banned from singles by ONAN regs, the broad shadow-casting Vaughts, flinty-eyed, tire executives' daughters out of Akron, using her-slash-their four legs to cover chilling amounts of court, plus to sweep the Charleston competition at every post-exhibition formal ball for the last 5 years running. Tavis will be on Wayne to play some sort of exhibitory thing, too, though asking Wayne to publicly smear a second Quebecer in 2 days might be a bit much. But everyone who's anyone will be down at the lung watching the Vaughts vivisect some adult-ranked nooks, plus maybe Wayne.
75.
Then the ETAs will get Saturday to rest and recharge before starting both the pre-Whataburger training week and the bell lap of prep for 12-12's boards, meaning late Friday night to Sunday a.m. will give Pemulus, Hal, and Axford, and maybe Struck if Pemulus needs to let Struck in for help with library tossing, enough time to psycho-spiritually rally from whatever meninges withering hangover the incredibly potent DMZ might involve. And Axford in the sauna predicted it would be a witherer indeed. Since even just LSD alone, he observed, left you the next day not just sick or down, but utterly empty, a shell, void inside, like your soul was a wrung-out sponge. Hal wasn't sure he concurred. An alcohol hangover was definitely no frolic in the psychic glade, all thirsty and sick and your eyes bulging and receding with your pulse. But after a night of involved hallucinogens, Hal said the dawn seemed to confer on his psyche a kind of pale, sweet aura, a luminescence.
76.
Halation, Axford observed. Pemulus appears to have left out of his calculations the fact that he'll get that Saturday PM off classes only if he makes the traveling list for the Tucson Whataburger the following week. And that unlike Hal and Axford, he's not a lock. Pemulus's USTA rank, accepting his Halcyon 13th year in the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken, has never gotten higher than 128. And the Whataburger draws kids from all over ONAN, and even Europe. The draw will have to be weak indeed for him to get even one of the 64 qualifying round invitations. Axford's on the fringes of the top 50, but He got to go last year at 17, so he's almost got to get to go. And Hal is looking at getting a third or maybe fourth seed in 18's singles. He's definitely going, barring some sort of cataclysmic ankle relapse against either Port Washington or Quebec. Axford postulates that Pemulis isn't miscalculating so much as simply showing a slitty-eyed confidence, which as far as his match play outlook is concerned would be unusual, and rather a fine thing. Pro-rector Aubrey DeLint says, publicly, that seeing M. Pemulis in practice versus seeing M. Pemulis in a real match that means anything is like getting to know some girl through email, as like email keyboard type pen pals, and really falling for her, and then finally meeting her in person and finding out she's got like just one enormous tit in the exact middle of her chest or something like that.
77.
Mario will get to come along if Avril can convince CT to bring him along to get Whataburger footage for this year's ETA promotional Christmas giveaway to private and incorporated patrons cartridge. Shocked and the glossy Syrian are laughing together about something up at the net post, where they've walked to gather gear and various spare rotator cuff and knee appliances after the Syrian kind of cornily jumped the net and pumped Shocked's hand, breath and sweat steam rising up off and moving off through the fence's mesh toward the manicured western hills, as Mario's laugh rings out at some broad mock supplicant's gesture Shocked's just now made. The 7th of November, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. You can be at certain parties and not really be there. You can hear how certain parties have their own implied ends embedded in the choreography of the party itself. One of the saddest times Joelle Van Dyne ever feels anywhere is that invisible pivot where a party ends, even a bad party. That moment of unspoken accord when everyone starts collecting his lighter and date, jacket or greatcoat, his one last beer hanging from the plastic rind's five rings, says certain perfunctory things to the hostess in a way that acknowledges their perfunctoriness without seeming insincere, and leaves, usually shutting the door. When everybody's voices recede down the hall, when the hostess turns back in from the closed door and sees the litter and the expanding white V of utter silence in the party's wake. Joelle, at the end of her rope and preparing to hang from it, listening, is supported by a polished hardwood floor above both river and bay's edge, perched uncomfortably in striated light in one of Molly Notkin's chairs molded in the likeness of great filmmakers from the celluloid canon. Seated between empty Cukor and frightening Murnau, in Malaise's fiberglass lap, his trousers crease uncomfortable, and his cummerbund MIT crested. The lurid chair's directors are larger than life. Joelle's feet dangle well off the floor, her squished hamstrings beginning to burn under a damp, thick cotton Brazilian skirt which is vivid, curled pale purples and fresh red against a Latin black that seems to glow above pale knees and white rayon knee socks and feet in clogs that are hanging half off, legs swinging like a child's, always feeling like a child in Molly's chairs, conspicuously perched in the eye of a bad party's somewhat forced-feeling storm of wit and good cheer. Sitting by herself under what used to be her window, the daughter of a low-pH chemist and homemaker from western Kentucky. A lot of fun to be with, normally, if you can get over the disconcerting veil. Among pernicious myths is the one where people always get very upbeat and generous and other-directed right before they eliminate their own map for keeps. The truth is that the hours before a suicide are usually an interval of enormous conceit and self-involvement. There are decorative bars, slender and of black iron, that pigeon droppings have made piebald, over the west windows to this third-floor cooperative apartment on the East Cambridge fringes of the Back Bay, where near Professor Notkin is holding a party to celebrate passing her orals in film and film cartridge theory, the doctoral program where Joelle, before her retreat into broadcast sound, had met her. Molly Notkin often confides on the phone to Joelle Van Dyne about the one tormented love of Notkin's life thus far. An erotically circumscribed G.W. Pabst scholar at New York University, tortured by the neurotic conviction that there are only a finite number of erections possible in the world at any one time, and that his tumescence means, for example, the detumescence of some perhaps more deserving or tortured third-world sorghum farmer or something, so that whenever he tumefies, he'll suffer the same order of guilt that your less eccentrically tortured PhD-type person will suffer at the idea of, say, wearing baby seal fur. Molly still takes the high-speed rail down to visit him every couple weeks, to be there for him in case, by some selfish mischance, he happens to harden, prompting in him black waves of self-disgust and an extreme neediness for understanding and non-judgmental love. She and poor Molly Notkin are just the same, Joelle reflects, seated alone, watching doctoral candidates taste wine. Sisters. Sororal twins. With her fear of direct light, Notkin. And the disguises and whiskers are simply veiled veils. How many sub-Rosa twins are there, out there, really? What if heredity, instead of linear, is branching? What if it's not arousal that's so finitely circumscribed? What if, in fact, there were ever only like two really distinct individual people walking around back there in history's mist? That all difference descends from this difference. The whole and the partial, the damaged and the intact, the deformed and the paralyzingly beautiful, the insane and the attendant, the hidden and the blindingly open, the performer and the audience, no Zen type one, always rather two, one upside down in a convex lens. Joelle is thinking about what she has in her purse. She sits alone in her linen veil and pretty skirt, obliquely looked at, listening to bits of conversation. She reels in out of the overall voice's noise, but seeing no one really else. The absolute end of her life and beauty running in a kind of stuttered, old, handheld 16mm before her eyes, projected against the white screen on her side for once from Uncle Bud, and twirling to Orin and Jim and YYY, all the way up to today's wet walk here from the Red Line's downtown stop, walking the whole way from East Charles Street, employing a self-conscious and kind of formal stride, but undeniably pretty. The overall walk at her last hours was, on this last day before the great O-N-A-N-ite Interdependence Revel. East Charles to the Back Bay today is a route full of rained-on, sienna-glazed streets and upscale businesses with awnings and wooden signs hung with cute colonial script, and people looking at her like you look at the blind, naked gazes, not knowing she could see everything at all times. She likes the wet walk for this, everything milky and halated through her veil's damp linen, the brick sidewalks of Charles Street unchipped and impersonally crowded, her legs on autopilot, she a perceptual engine, holding the collar of her overcoat closed at her poncho's neckline, in a way that lets her hold the veil secure against her face with a finger on her chin. Thinking always about what she has in her purse. Stopping in at a discount tobacconist and buying a quality cigar in a glass tube, and then a block later placing the cigar inside carefully in among the overflowing waste atop a corner receptacle of pine-green mesh, but keeps the tube, puts the glass tube in her purse, can hear the rains thup on tight umbrellas, and hear it hiss in the street, and can see droplets broken and regathering on her polyresin coat, cars sheening by with a special lonely sound of cars in rain, wipers making black rainbows on taxis' shining windshields. In every alley are green IWD dumpsters and the smaller red IWD dumpsters to take the overflow from the green dumpsters. And the sound of her wood-sole clogs against the receding staccato of brittle women's high heels on brick westward as Charles Street now approaches Boston Common and becomes less quaint and upscale, sodden litter, flat, the way only wet litter can be flat, appears on the sidewalk and in the curb seam. And now murky-colored people with sacks and grocery carts appraising that litter, squatting to lift and sift through litter, and the rustle and jut of limbs from dumpsters being sifted by people who all day do nothing but sift through IWD dumpsters, and other people's blue, shoeless limbs extending in coronal rays from refrigerator boxes in each block's three alleys, and the little cataract of rainwater off the edge of each dumpster's red annex's downsloping side, and hitting refrigerator boxes' tops with a rhythmless thappa-thappa-pa-thap. Somebody going psst from an alley's lip, and ghastly white or blotched faces declaiming to thin air from recessed doorways curtained by rain. And for an other-directed second, Joelle wishes she'd hung on to the cigar to give away, and moving westward into the territory of the endless stem near the end of Charles, she starts to dispense change she has asked for from doorways and inverted up-tilted boxes, and she gets asked about the deal with the veil with a lack of delicacy she rather prefers. A sooty wheelchaired man with a dead white face below a Notre Ray Pays cap silently extends a hand for coins. A puffed red cut across the businesslike palm is half-healed and almost visibly closing. It looks like a dent in dough. Joelle gives him a folded U.S. 20 and likes that he says nothing. She buys a .473-liter Pepsi Cola in a blunt plastic bottle at a Store 24, whose Jordanian clerk just looks at her blankly when she asks if they carry big red soda water, and settles for the Pepsi, and comes out and pours the pop out down a storm drain, and watches it pool there, foaming, brownly, and stay put because the drain's grate is clogged solid with leaves and sodden litter. She walks on toward the common with the empty bottle and glass tube in her purse. There is no need to buy chore boy pads at the Store 24. Joelle Van Dyne is excruciatingly alive and encaged, and in the director's lap can call up everything from all times. What will be that most self-involved of acts, self-canceling? To lock oneself in Molly Notkin's bedroom or bath and get so high that she's going to fall down and stop breathing and turn blue and die, clutching her heart. No more back and forth. Boston Common is like a lush hole Boston's built itself around. A 2 kilometer square of shiny trees and dripping limbs and green benches over wet grass. Pigeons all over, the same sooty cream as the willow's rinds. 3 young black men perched like tough crows along a bench's back approve her body and call her bitch with harmless affection and ask where's the wedding at. No more deciding to stop at 2300 hours, and then barely getting through the hour's show, and hurtling back home at 0130 hours and smoking the chore boy's resins and not stopping after all. No more throwing the material away, and then half an hour later rooting through the trash. No more all-fours scrutiny of the carpet in hopes of a piece of lint that looks enough like the material to try to smoke. No more singeing the selvage of veils. The common south edge is Boylston Street, with its 24/7 commerce, upscale cashmere scarves and cellular holsters, doormen with gold braid, jewelers with 3 names, women with valence curtain bangs, stores disgorging shoppers with their wide, white, monogrammed, twine-handled bags. The rain's wet veil blurs things like Jim had designed in his neonatal lens to blur things in imitation of a neonatal retina, everything recognizable and yet without outline. A blur that's more deforming than fuzzy, no more clutching her heart on a nightly basis. What looks like the cage's exit is actually the bars of the cage. The afternoon's meshes. The entrance says exit. There isn't an exit. The ultimate annular fusion, that of exhibit and its cage. Jim's own cage number 3, Free Show. It is the cage that has entered her, somehow. The ingenuity of the whole thing is beyond her. The fun has long since dropped off the too much. She's lost the ability to lie to herself about being able to quit, or even about enjoying it still. It no longer delimits and fills the hole. It no longer delimits the hole. There's a certain smell to a rain-wet veil, something about that caller and the moon saying the moon never looked away, revolving and yet not. She had hurtled on back home on the night's final tea and gone home and at least finally not turned her face away from the situation. The predicament that she didn't love it anymore. She hated it and wanted to stop, and also couldn't stop or imagine stopping or living without it. She had in a way done as they'd made Jim do near the end, and admitted powerlessness over this cage, this unfree show, weeping, literally clutching her heart, smoking first the chore boy scrap she'd used to trap the vapors and form a smokable resin, then bits of the carpet and the acetate panties she'd filtered the solution through hours earlier, weeping and veilless and yarn-haired, like some grotesque clown, in all four mirrors of her little room's walls. Chronology of Organization of North American Nations Revenue-Enhancing Subsidized Time, by year. 1. Year of the Whopper. 2. Year of the Tuck's Medicated Pad. 3. Year of the Trial-Size Dove Bar. 4. Year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken. 5. Year of the Whisper Quiet Maytag Dishmaster. 6. Year of the You Shit You 2007 Mimetic Resolution Cartridge View Motherboard Easy to Install Upgrade for Infernitron Interlaced TP Systems for Home, Office, or Mobile. 7. Year of Dairy Products from the American Heartland. 8. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. 9. Year of GLAD.
78.
Jim's eldest, Orin, punter extraordinaire, dodger of flung acid extraordinaire, had once shown Joel Van Dyne his childhood collection of husks of the Lemon Pledge that the school's players used to keep the sun off. Different sized legs and portions of legs, well-muscled arms, a battery of five-holed masks hung on nails from an upright fiberboard sheet. Not all the husks had names below them. Boylston Street East means she passes again the black bronze equestrian statue of Boston's Colonel Shaw and the Massachusetts 54th, illuminated now by a patch of emergent sunlight. Shaw's metal head and raised sword, illicitly draped in a large Quebecois fleur-de-lis flag with all four irises, stems, altered to red blades. So it's absurdly now a red, white, and blue flag. Three Boston cops on ladders with poles and shears. The Canadian militants come in the night, on the eve of interdependence, thinking anyone cares whether they hang things from historic icons, hang anti-ONAN flags, as if anyone not paid to remove them cares one way or the other. The encaged and suicidal have a really hard time imagining anyone caring passionately about anything. And here, too, are East Boylston's dealers, sirens of the other second cage, standing, as always, outside F.A.O. Schwartz. Young little black boys, boys so black they're blue, horrifically skinny and young, little more than living shadows in knit caps and knee-length sweatshirts and very white high tops, shifting and blowing into their cupped hands, alluding to the availability of a certain material, just barely alluding as all, with their postures and bored, blank, important gaze. Certain salesmen have only to stand there. Certain types of sales, the customer comes to you, and lo. The cops at the flag across the street don't give them a look. Joelle hurries past the line of dealers. She tries to, her clogs loose and clocking, tarrying for just a moment at the end, just past the gauntlet's end, still within two extended hands' reach of the last bored dealer. For here on the street outside Schwartz is placed an odd adverting display. Not a live salesman of any sort, but rather a humanoid figure of something that's better than cardboard. Untouched by the vendors, who don't seem even to look. A display on an angled rear mount stand, like a photo frame stand. 2D. The figure of a man in a wheelchair, in a coat and tie, his lap blanketed and no legs below. His well-fed face, artistically reddened with some terrible joy. His smile's arc of the extreme curvature that exists between mirth and fury. His ecstasy terrible to see. His head hairless and plastic and cast back. His eyes on the blue harlequin patches of the post-storm sky, looking straight up, or having a seizure, or ecstatic. His arms also up and out in a gesture of submission or triumph or thanks. His oddly thick right hand, the receptacle for the black spine of the case of some new film cartridge being advertised for distribution. The cartridge stuck like a tongue out of a slot in his lineless palm. Except there was only this display, this ecstatic figure, and a cartridge no feral vendors removed. No mention of title, no blurbs or quoted references to critics' thumbs. The case's spine itself, bare black, slightly pebble generic plastic, conspicuously unlabeled. Two Oriental women's shopping bags catch and make her raincoat billow slightly as Joelle stands there, briefly, feeling the line's dealers looking at her, assessing. And then someone calls something to one of the cops halfway up the statue, using his first name, which echoes slightly and breaks the spell. The little black boys look away. None of the passers-by seem to notice the display she stands before, reflecting. It's some kind of anti-ad, to direct attention at what is not said. Lead up to an inevitability you deny. Not new, but an expensive and affecting display. The film cartridge itself would be a blank, too, or the case empty. Worthless because it really can be removed all the way from the slot in the figure's hand. Joelle removes it and looks at it and puts it back. She's had her last fling with film cartridges. Jim had used her several times. Jim, at the end, had filmed her at prodigious and multi-lensed length and refused to share what he'd made of it and died without a note.
79.
Her mental name for the man had been Infinite Jim. The display cartridge shoves home with a click. One of the such young dealers calls her mama and asks, "Where's the funeral at?" For a while, after the acid, after first Oren left and then Jim came and made her sit through that filmed apology scene, and then vanished and then came back, but only 4 years, 7 months, 6 days passed to leave for a while after taking the veil. For a while she liked to get really high and clean, Joelle did. Scrub sinks until they were mint white. Dust the ceilings without using any kind of ladder. Vacuum like a fiend and put in a fresh vacuum bag after each room. Imitate the wife and mother they both declined to shoot. Use Incandenza's toothbrush on tiles grout. In places along Boylston, cars are triple parked. People's wipers are on that setting that Joelle, who does not drive, imagines to read occasional on the controls. Her own personal daddy's old car had wipers controls on the turn signal stalk by the wheel. Available yellow cabs pass, hissing in the streets. Over half the passing cabs out here in the rain are advertising themselves as available. Purple numbers lit below taxi. As she remembers things Jim was. Besides a great filmic mind and her true heart's friend, the world's best hailer of Boston cabs. Known to have less hailed than conjured cabs in spots where Boston cabs, by all that's right, just aren't. A hailer of Boston cabs in places like Vetersburg, Indiana, and Powell, Wyoming. Something in the authority of the lifted arm's height, the oncoming taxi undergoing a sort of parallax as it bore down over tumbleweed streets, appearing under Incandenza's upraised palm, as if awaiting benediction. He was a tall and physically slow-moving man with a great love of taxis, and they loved him back. Never again a cab in 4+ years after that. And so Joelle Van Dyne, a.k.a. Madame P., surrendered, suicidal, eschews tumbril or hack, her solid clog sounding formal on the smooth cement down Boylston's sidewalk past fine stores revolving doors, southeast, toward serious brownstone terrain, open coat swirling over poncho, and hanging rain breaking into stutters and drips. After she had smoked homemade freebase cocaine this AM for the last time, and then fired up the chore boys and good panties she'd used as a last filter, and choked on burnt acetate when she shredded and smoked them, and had wept and imprecated at the mirrors and thrown away her paraphernalia again for the final time, when an hour later she'd walked not formally to her tea stop under a parliament of gathering storm clouds and faint sticky bits of autumn thunder to ride to Upper Brighton and find Lady Delphina, get real weight from Lady Delphina, so hard to just cut it off in mid-binge, on a Saturday, unless she just passed out, to tell L.D. when she'd said goodbye, and it was the last time, it had been really the penultimate time, but that this was the last time. This was goodbye, for real. And get serious weight from Lady Delphina, pay her twice the 8-gram rate as a generous farewell as she walked without much real formality to her tea stop and stood on the platform, each time mistaking little mutters of thunder for the approach of the train, wanting more of it so badly she could feel her brain heaving around in its skull, then a pleasant and gentle-faced older black man in raincoat and hat, with a little flat black feather in the band, and the sort of black-framed styleless spectacles pleasant older black men wear, with the weary but dignified mild comportment of the older black, waiting alone with her on the chill, dim Davis Square subway platform. This man had folded his herald neatly lengthwise, and had it under the same arm he tipped his hat with, and said to excuse him, if this was an intrusion, he said, but he'd had occasion to see one or two of these linen veils before around, like what she wore, and was interested and rendered curious. He pronounced all 4 syllables of interested, which Joelle from Kentucky enjoyed. If he might be so bold, he said, tipping his hat. Joelle had engaged with him completely, which was extremely rare, even off the air. She rather welcomed the chance to think about anything else at all, with a train surely never pulling in. She reflected that the anecdote had gotten about, but not the incident's legacy, she said, as if that part were hidden. The Union of the Hideously and Improbably Deformed was unofficially founded in London in B.S. 1940, in London, United Kingdom, by the cross-eyed, palate-clefted, and wildly carbuncular wife of a junior member of the House of Commons, a lady whom Sir Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, having had several glasses of port plus a toddy at a reception for an American lend-lease administrator, had addressed in a fashion wholly inappropriate to social intercourse between civilized gentlemen and ladies. Unwittingly all but offering the union designed to afford the scopophobic, empathic fellowship and the genesis of sturdy inner resources through shame-free and unconstrained concealment. Winston Churchill, when the lady, no person's doormat, informed him with prim asperity that he appeared to be woefully inebriated, made the anecdotally famous reply that, while yes, yea verily, he was indeed inebriated, he would the following AM be once again sober, while she, dear lady, would tomorrow still be hideously and improbably deformed. Churchill, doubtless under weighty emotional pressures during this period in history, and then proceeded to extinguish his cigar in the lady's sherry, and to place a finger-bowl napkin delicately over the ruined features of her flaming visage. The laminated non-photo UHID membership card Joelle showed the interested old black gentleman related all this data and more in a point size so tiny the card looked somehow both blank and defaced. P. Putative Curriculum Vitae of Helen P. Steepley, 36, 1.93 meters tall, 104 kilograms in weight, AB, MJA. 1 year, time, graduate intern, newsmakers section. 16 months, decade magazine, hottest and nottest, a trends and style analysis column, until decade folded. 5 years, Southwest Annual, human interest, geriatric medical, personality and tourism articles. 5 months, Newsweek. 11 small features on trends and entertainment, until her executive editor, with whom she was in love, left Newsweek and took her with him. 1 year, Ladies' Day, personality and medical cosmetic features, some research firsthand, until 1 week in which the executive editor reconciled with his wife, an HPS got mugged and purse snatched on West 62nd, and vowed never again to live in Manhattan. 15 months to present, Moment Magazine, Southwest Bureau, Arithema, Arizona, medical, soft sports, personality, and home entertainment trends reporting, masthead byline, contributing editor status. Thereafter, proceeding first to the Upper Brighton and now the cooperative Back Bay Edge brownstone she had lived in once with Orrin and performed in with his father, and then passed on to Molly Notkin, today's party's guest of honor and hostess in one, as of yesterday enjoying ABD predoctoral status in film and film cartridge theory at MIT, having cleared the notorious hurdle of oral examinations on that day by offering her examination committee a dramatically rendered, and, if she did say so herself, devastating oral critique of post-millennial Marxist film cartridge theory from the point of view of Marx himself. Marx, as pretend film cartridge theorist and scholar. Still dressed as Karl Marx a day later in celebration, the glued beard matted and pubic black, Homburg ordered directly from Wiesbaden, soot from a terribly obscure British souvenir filth shop, she has no idea that Joelle's been in a cage since year of the trial-sized dove bar, has no idea what she and Jim in Condensa were even about for 21 months, whether they were lovers or what, whether Orrin left because they were lovers or what, whether Joelle even now lives hand to lung on a grossly generous trust willed her by a man she unveiled for but never slept with, the prodigious punter's father, infinite jester, director of a final opus so magnum he'd claim to have had it locked away.
80.
Joelle's never seen the completed assembly of what she'd appeared in, or seen anyone who's seen it, and doubts that any sum of scenes as pathologic as he'd stuck that long, quartzy, auto-wobbling lens on the camera and filmed her for could have been as entertaining as he'd said the thing he'd always wanted to make had broken his heart by ending up. Climbing to the third floor, stairs pale from wear, still trembling from the AM's interruptus, Joelle finds herself having a hard time climbing, as if the force of gravity goes up as she does. The party sounds start around the second landing. Here is Molly Notkin, dressed as a crumbling Marx again, greeting Joelle at her door, with a sort of delighted mock surprise U.S. hostesses use for greetings. Notkin secures Joelle's veil for her during removal of the beaded coat and poncho, then lifts the veil slightly in a practiced two-finger gesture to deliver a double-cheek kiss that is sour with cigarettes and wine. Joelle never smokes when veiled. Asking how Joelle got here, and then without waiting for an answer, offering her that odd kind of British Columbian apple juice they'd found they both liked so, and that Joelle at home's abandoned and gone back to the big red soda water of childhood, which Notkin doesn't know, and still cluelessly considers extra-sweet Canadian juice to be pretty much both her and Joelle's biggest vices. Molly Notkin's the kind of soul you want desperately to be polite to, but have to hide it with because she'd be mortified if she suspected you were ever just being polite to her about anything. Joelle makes a get-out-of-here gesture.
The really, really good kind?
The kind that looks muddy, it's so fresh.
Where'd you get it this late, this far east?
The kind you just about have to strain, it's so fresh. The living room is full and hot. Campy mambo playing. Walls, still the same off-white, but all the trim now a confectioner's rich brown. Or, plus there's wine, Joelle sees. A whole assortment on the old sideboard. It took 3 men with cigars and gray jumpsuits to get up the stairs when they got it. An assortment of bottles of different shapes and dim colors and different levels of what's inside. Molly Notkin has one dirty nailed hand on Joelle's arm and one on the head of a chair of Maya Darren, brooding avant-gardedly in vivid spun glass polymers, and is telling Joelle about her orals in a party's near shout that will leave her hoarse well before this big one's sad end. A good, muddy juice fills Joelle's mouth with spit that's as good as the juice, and her linen veil is drying and beginning once again comfortingly to flutter with her breath, and, perched alone and glanced at covertly, by persons who do not know they know her voice, she feels the desire to raise the veil before a mirror, to refine some of her purse's untouched material. Raise the veil, and set free the encaged, rapacious thing inside to breathe the only unclothed gas it can stomach. She feels ghastly and sad. She looks like death. Her mascara's all over the place. No one can tell. The plastic Pepsi bottle and glass cigar tube and lighter and packet of glycine bags are a shape in the corner of the rain-darkened cloth purse that rests on the floor just below her dangling clogs. Molly Notkin is standing with Rutherford Keck and Crosby Baum, an erratically bad-postured man before the school-supplied Infernitron viewer. Baum's wide back and pompadour obscure whatever's on the screen. Academics' voices sound nasal, with a cultivated stutter at sentences' start. A good many of James O. Incandenza's films were silent. He was a self-acknowledged visual filmmaker. His damaged, grinning boy, Joelle never got to know, because Oren had disliked him, often carried the case with the lenses, grinning like somebody squinting into bright light. That insufferable child actor, Smothergill, used to contort his face at the boy, and he'd just laugh, which sent Smothergill into tantrums that Miriam Prickett would resolve in the bathroom somehow. An old Latin Revival CD issues at acceptable volume from the speakers screwed into planters and hung with thin chains from each corner of the cream ceiling. Another large loose group is dancing in the cleared space between the cluster of directorial chairs and the bedroom door, most favoring Year of the Depend Adult Undergarments Minimal Mambo, this autumn's East Coast anti-craze, the dancers appearing to be just this side of standing still, the subtlest possible hints of fingers snapping under right-angled elbows. Oren and Condenza, she has not forgotten, had a poor, mottled, swollen elbow above a forearm the size of a leg of lamb. He had switched neatly from arm to leg. Joelle was Oren Incandenza's only lover for 26 months and his father's optical beloved for 21. A foreign academic with an almost Franciscan bald spot has the swirling limp of someone with a prosthesis, hired by MIT after her time. The better dancer's movements are so tiny they are evocative and compel watching, their near static mass curdled and bent somehow, subtly around one beautiful young woman, quite beautiful, her back undulating minimally in a thin, tight, blue-and-white-striped, sailorish top as she alludes to a cha-cha with maracas empty of anything to rattle, watching herself almost dance in the full-length mirror of quality plate that after Oren left, Joelle had forbidden Jim to hang and had slid beneath her bed face down. Now it's the west wall's framed mirror, hung between two empty ornate gilt frames. Notkin thinks she's been retro-ironic by having the frames themselves framed, in rather less ornate frames, in wry allusion to the early experialist fashion of making art out of the accessories of artistic presentation. The framed frames, hanging not quite evenly on either side of the mirror he'd cut for the scenes of that last ghastly thing he'd made her stand before, reciting in the openly empty tones she'd gone on to use on air. The girl stands, transfixed in alternating horizontal blue and white, then vertically sliced by bar-cut sunlight. Diced. Drunk. So wrecked on good vintage her lips hang slack, and the reflected cheeks' muscles have lost all integrity, and the cheeks jiggle like the outstanding paps in her little sailor's top. Apocalyptic rouge, and a nose ring that's either electrified or is catching bits of light from the window. She is watching herself with unselfconscious fascination in the only serviceable mirror here outside the bathroom. This absence of shame at the self-obsession. Is she Canadian? Mirror cult? Not possibly a UHID. The bearing's all wrong. But now, whispered to by a near motionless man in an equestrian helmet, she turns abruptly, falling away from her own reflection to explain, not to the man so much as no one in particular, the whole dancing mass. I was just looking up my tits, she says, looking down at herself. Aren't they beautiful? And it's moving. There's something so heartbreakingly sincere in what she says Joelle wants to go to her. Tell her it is, and we'll be completely all right. She's pronounced beautiful, like the earlier interested, in four syllables, splitting the diphthong, betraying her class and origin, with the heartbreaking openness Joelle's always viewed as either terribly stupid or terribly brave. The girl raising her striped arms in triumph, or artless thanks, for being constructed this way. These tits, built by whom and for whom never occurring, artlessly ecstatic. She is not drunk, Joelle now sees, but has taken ecstasy, Joelle can see, from the febrile flush and eyes jacked so wide you can make out brain meat behind the ball's poles, also known as X or MDMA, a beta something, an early synthetic, emotional acid, the love drug, so-called, big among the artistic young under, say, Bush and successors, since fallen into relative disuse because its pulverizing hangover has been linked to the impulsive use of automatic weapons in public venues. A hangover that makes a freebase hangover look like a day at the emotional beach. The difference between suicide and homicide consisting perhaps only in where you think you discern the cage's door. Would she kill somebody else to get out of the cage? Was the allegedly fatally entertaining and scopophiliac thing Jim alleges he made out of her unveiled face here at the start of the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar a cage or really a door? Had he even cut the tape into something coherent? There was nothing coherent in the mother-death cosmology and apologies she'd repeated over and over, inclined over that auto-wobbled lens propped up in the plaid-sided pram. He never let her see it, not even the dailies. He killed himself less than 90 days later. Fewer than 90 days? How much must a person want out to put his head in a microwave oven? A dim woman all the kids had known of in Boaz had put her cat in a microwave to dry it after a tick bath and set the oven just on defrost, and the cat ended up all over the woman's kitchen's walls. How would you rig the thing so it would activate with the door open? Is there some sort of refrigerator light button you could hold down and secure with tape? Would the tape melt? She cannot remember thinking of it once in 4 years. Did she kill him, somehow, just inclining, veilless, over that lens? The woman in love with her own breasts is being congratulated with the subtlest possible allusions to clapping hands from barely animate dancers with their glass tulips held between their teeth. And Vogelsong of Emerson College tries suddenly to stand on his head and is immediately ill in a spreading plum-colored ectoplasm the dancers do not even try to evade the spread of. And Joelle applauds the ecstatic woman as well, because they are, Joelle admits freely, the paps. They are attractive, which in the union is designated compelling within compatible relative limits. Joelle has no problem seeing beauty approved within compatible relative limits. She feels not empathy or maternal nurture any longer, just a desire to swallow every last drop of saliva she will ever manufacture and exit this vessel. Have 15 more minutes of too much fun. Eliminate her own map with the afflatus of the blind god of all doorless cages. And she lets herself slide forward from Melia's lap, a tiny fall, leading with her lumpy purse and glass of mad apple juice toward the door beyond the lines of a becalmed conga and doorway huddles of a warm and well-felt theoretical party. And then again delays, dithers, and the easement to the bathroom is blocked. She is the only veiled woman here, and an academic generation ahead of most of these candidates, and rather feared, even though not many know she is an aural personality, feared for quitting instead of failing. And because of the connection of the memory of Jim, and she is given a certain wide social berth, allowed to delay and orbit and stand unengaged at the fringes of shifting groups, obliquely glanced at, veil going concave at each in-breath, waiting with hip-shot nonchalance for the bathroom off the bedroom to clear. Aya Carino, the chaplain archivist, and a jaundiced yellow older man have gone into Molly's bedroom and left the door ajar, waiting nonchalantly, ignoring the foreign academic who wishes to know where she works with that veil, turning from him rudely, brain heaving in its bone box, memorizing every detail like collecting empty shells, sipping cloudy juice under neatly lifted corners of veil, now looking at instead of through the translucent cloth, the improbably deformed's equivalent of closing the eyes in concentration, on sound, letting the very last party wash over her, passed gracefully by different mingling guests, and once or twice almost touched, seeing only inrushing and then billowing white, listening to different mingling voices, the way the unveiled young taste wine.
This is a technologically constituted space.
Thing opens tight on Remington in a hideous grandfatherly flannel suit, black and white, straight full frontal shot on this grainy black and white stuff Bouvier taught him to manipulate the f-stop to mimic that horrid old Super 8, straight full frontal, staring past the camera, no attempt to disguise he's reading off a prompter, monotone and all, saying, "Few foreigners realize that the German term Berliner is also the Vulgate idiom for a common jelly donut." And thus Kennedy's seminal Ich bin ein Berliner was greeted by the Teutonic crowds with a delight only apparently political. At which point he aims his thumb and finger at his own temple, at which point his TA doubles the focal length, so there's this giant...
"I would die to defend your constitutional right to error, friend. But in this one case, you..."
They used to be less beautiful, but then Rutherford said to quit sleeping face down.
No, I'm saying that this whole thing, what you and I are discoursing within, is a technologically constituted space.
Adonis savant foie au poison.
It's good cheese, but I've had better cheese.
Man wearing, this is Kirby. Kirby, he is in pain. He's been telling me about it, and now he'd like to tell you about it.
Complete mystery why Eve Blum didn't show. It's known she'd re-up for the part. The whole rest of them were there, even Henderson, and that Davis woman is Alice, who had to be wheeled out under nurse's care. My God, and Peter? Looking as if he'd eaten nothing but pastry for the past 40 years. Greg with that absurd hairpiece and snakeskin boots. Yes, but all the kids recognizable underneath somehow this pre-digital insistence on continuity through time that was the project's whole magic and raison. You know this. You're current on pre-digital phenomenology and Brady theory. And then, but now, here's this entirely incongruous middle-aged black woman playing Jan.
Degustibus non est disputantum.
Balls. An incongruous central blackness could have served to accentuate the terrible whiteness that had been in illuc... The entire historical effect of a seminal program was horribly, horribly altered. Terribly altered.
Eisenstein and Kurosawa and Michaud walk into a bar.
You know these mass-market cartridges for the masses? The ones that are so bad they are somehow perversely good? This was worse than that. So-called phantom, but real and mobile. First the spine, then not the spine, but the right eye socket. Then the old socket's fit as a fiddle, but the thumb, the thumb doubles me over. It won't stay put. Fucks with the emotions gradient so that all the tesseract's angles appear to be right angles, except in...
So what I did, I set up right next to him, you see? So in a sense, he didn't have room to stalk or draw a bead. Keck had said they needed a good 10 meters, so I cocked the hat just so, just ever so slightly, like so, just cocked it over to the side, like so, and sat down practically on the man's knee, asked after his show carp. He keeps pedigreed carp. And, of course, you can imagine what...
A more interesting issue from a Heideggerian perspective is a priori, where the space as a concept is inframed by technology as a concept. It has a mobile cunning, a kind of wraith or phantom-like...
Because they're emotional more labile at that stage.
So get dentures, she said.
So get dentures?
So who shot the incision? Who did the cinematography on the incision?
Way it can be film qua film, Comstock says if it even exists, it has to be something more like an aesthetic pharmaceutical. Some beastly post-annular scopophiliacal vector. Supra-subliminals and that. Some kind of abstractable hypnosis. An optical dopamine cue. A recorded delusion. Duquette says he's lost contact with 3 colleagues. He said a good bit of Berkeley isn't answering their phone.
I don't think anyone here would dispute that they're absolutely fetching tits, Melinda.
We had blinis with caviar.
There were tartines.
We had sweetbreads and mushroom cream sauce.
He said it was all on him. He said he was treating. There was roast artichoke topped with a sort of fly only. Mutton stuffed with foie gras. Double chocolate rum cake. 7 kinds of cheese. A kiwi glacé and brandy and snifters you needed 2 hands to swirl.
That coke-addled fag and his Morris Mini. The prosthetic film scholar.
Fans do not begin to keep it all in the great convexity. It creeps back in. What goes around, it comes back around. This your nation refuses to learn. It will keep creeping back in. You cannot give away your filth and prevent all creepage, no? Filth by its own nature is a thing that is creeping always back. Me, I can remember when your Charles was café with cream.
Look now at it.
It is the Blue River. You have a river outside you that is robin eggs blue.
I think you mean great concavity, Elaine.
I mean great convexity. I know what is the thing I meant.
And then it turned out he put ipecac in the brandy. It was the most horrible thing you've ever seen. Everyone, all over, spouting like whales. I'd heard the term projectile vomiting, but I never thought that I... You could aim. The pressure was such that you could aim. And out come his grad technicians from under the tablecloths like overhang, and he pulls out a canvas chair and clapper and begins filming the whole horrible, staggering, spouting, groaning...
This ultimate cartridge's aesthetic death rumor has been going around like a lazy toilet since Dishmaster, for Christ's sake. Simply make inquiries, mention some obscure foundation grant, obtain the thing through whatever shade of market the thing's alleged to be out in. Have a look! See, there's doubtless just high-concept erotica, or an hour of rotating whorls. Or something like late Makaveyev, something that's only entertaining after it's over, on reflection.
The striated parallelogram of PM sunlight is elongated in transit across the co-op's eastern wall, over bottle-laden sideboard and glass cabinet of antique editing equipment, and louvered vent and shelves of art cartridges in their dull black and dun cases. The mole-studded man in the equestrian helmet is either winking at her or has a tick. There's the pre-suicide's classic longing. Sit down one second. I want to tell you everything. My name is Joelle Van Dyne, Dutch-Irish, and I was reared on family land east of Shiny Prize, Kentucky, the only child of a low pH chemist and his second wife. I now have no accent except under stress. I am 1.7 meters tall and weigh 48 kilograms. I occupy space and have mass. I breathe in and breathe out. Joelle has never before today been conscious of the sustained volition required to just breathe in and breathe out, her veil recessing into nose and rounded mouth, and then bowing out slightly like curtains over an open pane.
Convexity. Concavity. Convexity. Concavity, damn your eyes.
The bathroom has a hook and a mirrored medicine cabinet over the sink and is off the bedroom. Molly Notkin's bedroom looks like the bedroom of someone who stays in bed for serious lengths of time. A pair of pantyhose has been tossed onto a lamp. There are not crumbs but whole portions of crackers protruding from the gray surf of wops-it-up bedding. A photo of the phalloneurotic New Yorker with the same fold-out triangular support as the blank cartridge's anti-ad. A Ziploc of pot and easy widers and seeds in the ashtray. Books with German and Cyrillic titles lie open in spine-cracking attitudes on the colorless rug. Joelle's never liked the fact that Notkin's father's photograph is nailed at iconic height to the wall above the headboard. A systems planner out of Knoxville, Tennessee, his smile, the smile of a man who wears white loafers and a squirting carnation. And why are bathrooms always way brighter lit than whatever room they're off? On the private side of the bathroom door, she's had to take two damp towels off the top of to close all the way. The same rotten old hook for a lock never quite ever seeming to want to fit its receptacle in the jam. The party's music now some horrible collection of mollified rock classics with all soft rock's grim dental associations. The business side of the door is hung with a selective automation of Knoxville calendar from before subsidized time and cutout photos of Kinski as Paganini and Leo as Dwanell, and a borderless still of the crowd scene in what looks like Peterson's The Lead Shoes, and rather curiously the off-printed image of J. Van Dyne, M.A.'s one and only published film theory monograph.
81.
Joelle can smell, through her veil and own stale exhalations, the little room's complicated spice of sandalwood rubble and a little violet-ribboned pomander and deodorant soap, and the sharp, decayed lemon odor of stress diarrhea. Low-budget celluloid horror films created ambiguity and possible elision by putting a question mark after the end, is what pops into her head. The end? Amid the odors of mildew and dicky academic digestion? Joelle's mother's family had no indoor plumbing. It is all right. She represses all pathetic, this will be the last thing I smell thought patterns. Joelle is going to have too much fun in here. It was beyond all else so much fun at the start. Oren had neither disapproved nor partaken. His urine was an open book because of football. Jim hadn't disapproved so much as been vacant with disinterest. His too much was neat bourbon, and he had lived life to the fullest, and had gone in for detoxification again and again. This had been simply too much fun at the start. So much better even than nasaling the material up through rolled currency and waiting for the cold, bitter drip at the back of your throat, and cleaning the newly spacious apartment to within an inch of its life while your mouth twitches and writhes unbidden beneath the veil. The base frees and condenses, compresses the whole experience to the implosion of one terrible shattering spike in the graph, an inflated orgasm of the heart that makes her feel, truly, attractive, sheltered by limits, deveiled and loved, observed and alone and sufficient and female, full, as if watched for an instant, by God. She always sees, after inhaling, right at the apex of the graph's spike's tip, Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa, behind glass at the Vittoria for some reason, the saint recumbent, half supine, her flowing stone robe lifted by the angel, in whose other hand a bare arrow is raised for that best descent, the saint's legs frozen in opening, the angel's expression not charity, but the perfect vice of barb-headed love. The stuff had not just been her encaging God, but her lover, too. Fiendish. Angelic. Of rock. The toilet seat is up. She can hear a helicopter's chop somewhere overhead east. A traffic helicopter over Staro. And Molly Notkin's shriek as an enormous glass crash sounds off in the living room. Imagines her beard hanging aslant and her mouth ellipsed with champagne's foam. As she waves off the breakage that signals, good party, can hear through the door the ecstatic Melinda's apologies and Molly's laugh, which sounds like a shriek.
Oh, everything falls off the wall sooner or later.
Joelle has lifted her veil back to cover her skull like a bride. Since she threw away her pipes and bowls and screens again this AM, she is going to have to be resourceful. On the counter of an old sink, the same not quite white as the floor and ceiling, the wallpaper is a maddening, uncountable pattern of roses, twined in garlands on sticks. On the counter are an old splay-bristled toothbrush, tube of gleam rolled neatly up from the bottom, unsavory old no-coat scraper, rubber cement, negrum, depilatory ointment, tube of monostat not squeezed from the bottom. Thony beard whisker bits and curled green threads of used mint floss and parapectillin, and a wholly unsqueezed tube of diaphragm foam, and no makeup but serious styling gel in a big jar with no lid and hairs around the rim, and an empty tampon box half filled with nickels and pennies and rubber bands. And Joelle sweeps an arm across the counter and squunches everything over to the side under the small rod, with a washcloth wrung viciously out and dried in the tight spiral of a twisted cord. And if some items do totter and fall to the floor, it is all right because everything eventually has to fall. On the cleared counter goes Joelle's misshapen purse. The absence of veil dulls the bathroom's smells somehow. She's been resourceful before, but this is the most deliberate Joelle has been able to be about it in something like a year. From the purse, she removes the plastic Pepsi container, a box of wooden matches kept dry in a resealable baggie, two little thick glycine bags, each holding 4 grams of pharmaceutical-grade cocaine, a single-edge razor blade, increasingly tough to find, a little black Kodachrome canister whose gray lid she pops and discards to reveal baking soda, sifted fine as talc, the empty glass cigar tube, a folded square of Reynolds wrap foil the size of a playing card, and an amputated length of the bottom of a quality wire coat hanger. The overhead light casts shadows of her hands over what she needs, so she turns on the light over the medicine cabinet's mirror as well. The light stutters and hums and bathes the counter with cold lithium-free fluorescence. She undoes the 4 pins and removes the veil from her head and places it on the counter with the rest of the material. Lady Delphina's little glycine baglets have clever seals that are green when sealed and blue and yellow when not. She taps half a glycine's worth into the cigar tube and adds half again as much baking soda, spilling some of the soda in a parenthesis of bright white on the counter. This is the most deliberate she's been able to be in at least a year. She turns the sink's C knob and lets the water get really cold, then cranks the volume back to a trickle, and fills the rest of the tube to the top with water. She holds the tube up straight and gently taps on its side with a blunt, unpainted nail, watching the water slowly darken the powders beneath it. She produces a double rose of flame in the mirror that illuminates the right side of her face as she holds the tube over the match's flame and waits for the stuff to begin to bubble. She uses two matches, twice. When the tube gets too hot to hold, she takes and folds her veil and uses it as a kind of oven mitt over the fingers of her left hand. Careful, from habit and experience, not to let the bottom corners get close enough to the flame to brown. After it's bubbled for just a second, Joelle shakes out the matches with a flourish and tosses them in the toilet to hear that briefest of hisses. She takes up the black wire prod from the hanger and begins to stir and mash the just-bubbled stuff in the tube, feeling it thicken quickly and its resistance to the wire's tiny circles increase. It was when her hands started to tremble during this part of the cooking procedure that she'd first known she liked this more than anyone can like anything and still live. She is not stupid. The charles, rolling away far below the windowless bathroom, is livid blue, more mildly blue, on top from the fresh rainwater that had made purple rings appear and widen, a deeper magic marker-type blue below the dilute layer, gulls stamped to the cleared sky, motionless as kites. A bulky thump sounds from behind the large flat-top Enfield Hill on the river's south shore. A large but relatively shapeless projectile of drums wrapped in brown postal paper and belted with twine, hurtling in a broad upward arc that bothers the gulls into dips and wheels. The brown package quickly a pinpoint in the yet hazy sky to the north, where a yellow-brown cloud hangs just above the line between sky and terrain, its top slowly dispersing and opening out, so that the cloud looks like a not very pretty sort of waste basket, waiting. Inside, Joelle hears only a bit of the bulky thump, which could be anything. The only other thing besides what she's about to do too much of here right now she'd ever come close to feeling this way about. In Joelle's childhood, Paducah, not too bad a drive from Shiny Prize, still had a few public movie theaters, 6 and 8 separate auditoria clustered in single honeycombs at the edges of interstate malls. The theaters always ended in flex, she reflected. The this-oplex and that-oplex. It had never struck her as odd, and she never saw even one film there, as a girl, that she didn't just about die with love for. It didn't matter what they were. She and her own personal daddy up in the front row. They sat in the front rows of the narrow little over-insulated plexes up in neck-crick territory and let the screen fill their whole visual field. Her hand in his lap and their big box of Cracker Jacks in her hand and soda pops secure in little rings cut out of the plastic of their seat's arms. And he, always with a wooden match in the corner of his mouth, pointing up into the rectangular world at this one or that one. Performers, giant, flawless, 2D beauties iridescent on the screen. Telling Joelle over and over again how she was prettier than this one or that one right there. Standing in the placid line as he bought the Plex's paper tickets that looked like grocery receipts, knowing that she was going to love the celluloid entertainment no matter what it was, wonderfully innocent, still thinking quality referred to the living teddy bears in Qantas commercials. Standing, handheld, eyes even with his wallet's back pocket bulge, she never so much again as in that line felt so taken care of. Destined for big screen entertainment's unalloyed good fun. Never once again until starting in with this lover, cooking and smoking it 5 years back, before Incandenza's death at the start. The punter never made her feel quite so taken care of, never made her feel about to be entered by something that didn't know she was there, and yet was all about making her feel good anyway, coming in. Entertainment is blind. The improbable thing of the whole thing is that when the soda and water and cocaine are mixed right and heated right and stirred just right as the mix cools down, then when the stuff's too stiff to stir and is finally ready to come on out, it comes out slick as shit from a goat, Just an inverted ketchup bottle thump, and out the son of a fucking horse slides. One molded cylinder hardened onto the black wire. Its snout round from the glass tube's bottom. The average pre-chopped freebase rock looks like a 38 round. What Joel now slides with three Phillips from the cigar tube is a monstrous white wiener, a county fair corn dog. Its sides a bit rough, like mache. A couple clots left on the inside of the tube that are what you forage and smoke before the chore boys and panties. She is now a little under 2 deliberate minutes from too much fun for anyone mortal to hope to endure. Her unveiled face in the dirty lip mirror is shocking in the intensity of its absorption. Out in the bedroom doorway, she can hear Reeves Mainwaring telling some helium-voiced girl that life is essentially one long search for an ashtray. Too much fun. She uses the razor blade to cross-section chunks out of the freebase wiener. You can't whittle thin deli-shaved flakes off because they'll crumble back to powder right away, and they anyway don't smoke as well as you'd think. Blunt chunks are standard operating procedure. Joelle chops out enough chunks for maybe 20 good-sized hits. They form a little quarry on the soft cloth of her folded veil on the counter. Her Brazilian skirt is no longer damp. Reeves Mainwaring's blonde imperial often had little bits of food residue in it. The ecstasy of St. Teresa is on perpetual display at the Vittoria in Rome, and she never got to see it. She will never again say, "And lo," and invite people to watch darkness dance on the face of the deep. The Face of the Deep had been the title she'd suggested for Jim's unseen last cartridge, which he'd said would be too pretentious, and then used that skull fragment out of the Hamlet graveyard scene instead. Which, talk about pretentious, she'd laughed. His frightened look, when she'd laughed, is, for the life of her, the last facial expression memory she can remember of the man. Oren had referred to his father sometimes as himself, and sometimes as the mad stork, and once in a slip as the sad stork. She lights one wooden match and blows it right out and touches the hot black head to the side of the plastic pop bottle. It melts right through and makes a little hole. The helicopter is probably a traffic helicopter. Somebody at their academy had had some connection to some traffic helicopter that had had an accident. She can't for the life of her. No one out there knows she is in here getting ready to have too much. She can hear Molly Notkin calling through rooms about, "Has anyone seen Keck?" In her first theory seminar, Reeves Mainwaring had called one film wretchedly ill-conceived and another desperately acquiescent, and Molly Notkin had pretended to have a coughing fit, and it had a Tennessee accent, and that was how they met. The Reynolds wrap is to make a screen that will rest in the bottle's open top. A regular dub screen is the size of a thimble. Its sides spread out like an opening bud. Joelle uses the point of some curved nail scissors on the back of the toilet to poke tiny holes in the rectangle of aluminum foil and shapes it into a shallow funnel large enough to siphon gasoline, narrowing its tip to fit in the bottle's mouth. She now owns a pipe with a monster-sized bowl and screen now and puts in enough chunklets to make 5 or 6 hits at once. The little rocks lie there piled and yellow-white. She puts her lips experimentally to the melted hole in the side of the bottle and draws, then, very deliberately, lights another match and extinguishes it and makes the hole bigger. The idea that she'll never see Molly Notkin or the Cerebral Union or her